where is that?
He's over there.
He is.
He's just walking.
Okay. Someone go ahead and start the meeting. Roll call.
Mayor Lundberg.
Here.
Councilors Van Gordon.
Here.
Moe.
Here.
Moore.
Here.
Stare.
Here.
Woodrow.
Here.
Missionary.
Present.
So we have two things on the agenda. The first is our 2019 Municipal Court Report with Judge Trains. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming and meeting with us for the report.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to present. And so just to start off, it's a privilege for me to serve this community, and I appreciate the opportunity that you've given me to do so. I did draft a report. I tried to include in that report meaningful information, not knowing what my predecessor did in terms of reports to the council and the kinds of information that you wanted to hear. I sort of had to grasp at what you might find to be meaningful or helpful. And so I thought, in a nutshell, just understanding the kinds of cases that we hear misdemeanor, violation, offenses that all happen within the corporate limits of the city of Springfield. The types of charges that we're seeing and any trends, as you can see, traditionally DUI has been the most frequently cited case or arresting case in the work court. And this last year was the first time that we got trumped by criminal trespass too. And then you can see the violation level offenses we have. I thought it might be helpful to understand the court structure, so I'll give you a rundown of that. And then I highlighted the challenges that we're facing now that we're likely going to be facing in the future. In terms of our staff time, we spend roughly 50% of our time on violation matters and roughly 50% on criminal matters. On the bench, we probably spend about 3/5 of our time dealing with criminal matters, but off the bench is primarily violation matters. It's letters and requests of the court to take action on violation cases. So it's pretty evenly split administrative staff, judge time on violation cases and criminal cases. I don't want to just read through the report, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to ask questions or ask for more information on the challenges. And before I dive into the challenges, I guess my first question is, what sorts of things did you want to hear about from me? And if I can't answer those questions today, I'd like to have the opportunity to circle back around at some later point with information if I don't have that today. Okay, question.
Criminal trespass too, is that breaking and entering?
No. Criminal trespass too is unlawful entry or unlawfully remaining on a premises. And so it's generally a situation where somebody is overstayed their welcome at a store or a business, and they're told, you need to leave, and they don't leave. Or if the city has a letter of trespass, the police department has a letter of trespass from a business owner, and a person is around the business after hours, then they have the authority to act as the person in charge of that premises and make an arrest. So yeah. Breaking and entering would be burglary. It would probably be much more serious offense if they're actually breaking into.
Yeah, I'm looking at the numbers, and it does look like there are a lot more of that than anything else. And I guess we've got some people who don't want to take the hint.
Yes. Sometimes it's people overstaying, that said they're welcome in a business or at a store, and they're being asked to leave, don't leave. Sometimes, unfortunately, it happens at the hospital. An individual is being asked to leave, don't want to leave, stay with the staff, contacts, police department, and if cahoots can't intervene, then they end up having to take law enforcement action.
Now that I'm looking at it again, it looks like the numbers on this criminal trespass too are staying pretty steady over the last 5 years, but everything else is going down. Is that fairly accurate?
In terms of the numbers of cases?
The number of cases. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing.
Good.
Sharon.
So, thank you very much for the report. Added a lot of information. I guess I wanted to go right to the challenges.
Yes.
Because I'm assuming that some of the criminal trespass has to do with mental issues and maybe sobriety issues. And you speak to it, but I didn't see a lot of solution necessarily here, and so I wondered if that was something that you were going to address.
Solutions are a challenge, and one of the things that we're trying to do is to have a discharge planner, somebody who's working in the jail, who's also working with the court in connecting people with either mental health services or substance abuse treatment services. We don't have a mental health court in this court. We could look into setting up a mental health court. There are pros and cons to having mental health courts. One of the cons is that oftentimes it prolongs a person who has mental illness, prolongs their engagement with the criminal justice system, sometimes in years, sometimes a year and a half, beyond what a person without a mental health issue would have with the court. So that's
is that a bad thing?
For some people it is, because if they don't engage, then they can be sanctioned.
Okay.
And that's really the only hammer that the court has. If you don't engage, then do we look at jail time? Do we look at community service? Do we look at work crew? What do we look at? And so when it's working well, it's a good thing. If it's not working well, you wonder if there aren't more appropriate ways of engaging human services.
But are we seeing them as repeat offenders anyway?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes it's emerging mental illness. And so we're trying to get those people as quickly as possible into treatment programs. We do have a jail intercept program that has been fairness in terms of its effectiveness with us. But I primarily see the role of the court as using the court to engage people in services that already exist out. And our community is challenged in engaging the very difficult to engage. And that's one of the things that I'm working at on a very regular basis, is to work with Lane County Behavior Health to see if we can create crisis centers with enforcement to the group of people. To our meeting this morning, where we were talking about whether that is a potential for the county and also for Springfield. So solutions are difficult to come by. We're not mental health providers in the court. The folks down in the jail are not mental health providers. We're trying to get that on the discharge planner position that we provide services for the court, engaging people with appropriate.
So I guess one other just follow up on that. How much of the court business does deal with repeat offenders? Do you have any kind of statistics that,
I would have to get that information. I at one point looked at that information. We have a program in our community called the Frequent User System. And so it is
a frequent user for courts and law enforcement.
Law enforcement, fire, EMT, and emergency rooms. And we get that list. They have a list of about 115 people. And they are often the frequent flyers in our court. And we do try to create opportunities for people to engage with the youth program, but it's a very problem. They don't want the court to force people to engage because it's counterproductive to their. We do see a handful of frequent flyers that cycle through, and we are challenged with trying to break that cycle. One of the problems is the next challenge, which is the 6-month center report, which deals with how you compensate our public defenders. And when we go into problem solving mode and we're having to have repeated court appearances, we try to figure out how do we break the cycle, how do we problem solve this behavior. It increases the time that they have to spend on cases, which then creates that issue with their compensation matching the work that they're getting in. And the impact or the input that I'm getting from our public defenders is that it's reached a crisis level for them.
Okay.
And that they cannot hire replacements. They lose the public defender because the work is simply not attractive. And that's a difficult place for a city to be in because we have a legal obligation to make sure that we're providing effective assistance and counsel for the people that are in our criminal have to do that. It's a non-negotiable thing. And how you come up with appropriate compensation and effective assistance is the challenge.
Canius, so I'd like to know about the repeat offenders and how much time and effort we spend on that. But I'd also like to some kind of a cost basis for that as well. You know, so yeah, intervention might be less expensive than the cycling.
Right.
And what, you know, what would that be? I don't know.
So I can hunt down those numbers for you. The numbers of repeat offenders and looking at a pattern of years rather than just 1 year. The costs is it's a little harder.
A little more difficult. Yes,
a little more difficult. I can estimate the cost of the public defender, costs the jail, can give them an estimate of what it costs them to house a person. The law enforcement costs might be a little more difficult to capture.
Right.
Our administrative costs might be a little more difficult to capture. Bench time would be captured. That.
Yeah,
and so
it's kind of a ballpark idea.
Yeah,
I really appreciate that.
And there are grants that called Justice Reinvestment Grants that are put out through the state, through the Criminal Justice Commission, where I'm buying in every 2 years they come out. The whole idea is that you invest in prevention and intervention and you save money.
Right, in the long run.
And that's definitely something that as a system we take a look at. I just noticed today that the grant RFP came out for this next and of course we'll go through the normal grant process if it looks like there's something that we won't apply for. But these intervention programs, these creative programs are expensive if you look at it from that sense, but if you look at it from what do you save,
right,
what are the costs to the system that you're saving, they can be cost effective as well,
right,
as you're reinvesting money.
And they're not always proven, you know, effective. That's one of the other issues I know. So, thank you.
So, before you call in, Mitchell, I just want to back up for a second because, Jen, is there something you wanted us to sort of take a look at first? Because we kind of jumped into questions without giving you an opportunity to talk about any of it. I think your goals and your overview were very much in line with, I think, what the city wants to see in terms of how our courts function. So thank you for expressing it the way you did. But I just want to know, is there something that you would like us maybe to highlight that this is working pretty well, this is not working well? I know that security is one thing you pointed out. So that we can take a look at, you know, what can we do here at this table today that maybe give you some sense of we're going to try and help the situation if we need to, or this is going real well, so we just need to be more supportive.
I think my goal in coming here was to give you just an overview of the court, but also help you to understand that these challenges that we're facing are real challenges, and we are going to need to change the way that we're doing business in terms of dealing with folks that are cycling through due to either untreated or undertreated mental health issues or untreated or undertreated substance abuse issues. That's something that we need to figure out. We need more tools than we currently have for that. It's just identifying what those tools will be and how do we get there. Do we grant sources? Do we figure out innovative ways of dealing with folks that break the cycle of recidivism? And I was hoping, I think more than anything, to just have you understand that this is an issue. It's not unique to us. I found out today as well that as a county, we have the highest rates of meth and opioid use in the state. And as of the last couple of years, we also have the highest levels of psychiatric medication use in the state. Those might be current. The person who gave that wasn't sure how old those stats were. And you add those together, and it gives you the perfect recipe for why we see these issues and why they're so difficult. And nobody has great answers, but we're all trying to come up with ideas. And I think if we get enough momentum behind them, we all understand that they're priorities for us.
Well,
hopefully see long-term change.
Thank you. Sean, Joe, and then Leonard.
Thanks, Judge, for the great presentation. I think, to Sherry's questions, I think all those numbers exist on the FEWS report, and I would just maybe pull them, you know, all those cost numbers that the county's already tracked down. I think when we have conversations about costs and system costs, it's really important to understand some of this is just fixed, right? Like, the cost of the jail is the cost of the jail, and we're not, like, we can keep people out of it. But, you know, we're sort of, it's a sunk cost at this point. Are you working with Trillium at all?
Yes. In fact, they are spearheading the potential of us opening a crisis center. And the crisis center at this point is undefined. We tried to spend 2 hours today defining, is it primarily going to be for law enforcement officers as an alternative to taking people to jail? Or is it going to be a pre-law enforcement intercept? Is it going to be working out in the community and setting up perhaps more crisis centers like Hourglass in different places? What is it going to look like? And we threw out a bunch of ideas today. There was no consensus. The Trillium is working on that. Trillium also has an innovation here. I think they're due in February. I had a great idea for an innovation grant that I tried to run past them before I brought it through any formal process, but they have to have those by February. And so we missed the deadline for that.
They are an underutilized partner because I think the real money in situations like this relies in the health industry. And my advice would be to really go back and get, if you can even get the contract that they signed with the state and understand what their obligations are, because it's a lot wider than what people expect. I know what it is in Texas because I just got back from there, but I don't know what Trillium's specific one is. But there's a lot of language that tends to be in those contracts about addressing gaps in care, you know, case discharge, and a lot of different places that they can engage that I would encourage you to build upon it. And maybe this is a conversation for the financial and legal committee, but I would even be open to the, what the public defender conversation is, to look at some scenario where if they're opting into it, if somebody's opting into a program, where we at least help pay the, you know, pay additional legal fees to the public defender to keep them into some of those optional programs and keep them going forward, opposed to the flat rate. I don't know what that would look like, but, you know, I'm looking at Joe saying, if you guys come up with something, I'll be there behind you guys.
Joe.
So the flat rate thing is something we got to talk about. Because there's been some shifting going around, and it just, we need to look at it with, there's, I don't know what law or case came down or what strategy is being used, but I think that we're obligated to, or being challenged, that we're obligated to be able to provide a decent defense to the two folks, defendants, and not have a system. If you have money, you got defense. If you don't, too bad. And so that I think is a hot button, and it's definitely on the front plate. And going back to that preemptive strike, so to speak, we're talking about, there was, did Carol ever get a hold of you from Lane County in regards to, was it Carol, that from Lane County Human Services, where they may have had an extra person that can come over to help put together that program that we were talking about earlier this year?
No one got in touch with me. Was the Yellow Line project that we were talking
yes.
about?
Yeah, but you know, it's preemptive. You're talking about a preemptive where you know, you have people, like right now you're talking about Trillium, you're saying, well, we don't know whether it should be where it's at the police contact level or before the police contact level.
Right.
And I think there's enough at the police level because it's more acute, and then you can start whittling your way down to less acute and less higher or less of crisis. But that program that I think it was that Yellow Line with that county from out of state, I really think that is something we should, hopefully you're still moving towards and have some energy behind, and if you need support, I think that's important because I believe that's the right ingredient to get some of these folks to help them and get them, not let them get dumped into the system right away and try to get that stopped and prevent them from becoming one of those recidivists. So I don't know how far you got in that.
Just Just a note on the Project Air One. So that's a program out of Minnesota.
Minnesota, right.
Michigan, one of those.
Yeah.
And they presented at a conference earlier in the year, Justice Reinvestment Conference. And Councilor Fishnery and myself and some other personnel from Springfield went there. And they basically gave everybody all of their documentation, all of their resources, saying, take what we've done, duplicate it in your community. You come from a fairly rural, small community, and they had some pretty compelling information. And they had multiple areas of diversion. So an officer contacting an individual on the street could, instead of taking traditional law enforcement action, divert them into a system. Once the person gets to the jail, the person could be diverted into a different system. Once the person is charged with an offense and is now awaiting trial, they could be diverted. So there were multiple levels of intercept there. And what's notable, however, that was Project Yellow Line was spearheaded by law enforcement and in partnership with the community health organization. So it wasn't spearheaded by the court. It wasn't spearheaded by attorneys. It was sort of a grassroots effort because law enforcement officers were frustrated with the lack of resources they had. And so the information I've gotten from my conversations with Rick's folks has been positive, but there needs to be some trust built between Lincoln Behavioral Health, that they would be the organization who would be providing services, and the law enforcement officers in terms of handing somebody off who's committing crimes in the community and feeling confident that that person is going to be down the next block within 15 minutes.
Sorry, I asked them, what do you need, what can we do as a group to help move that along instead of kicking a can?
They had a project coordinator, at least one project coordinator.
Right.
They, I think, built it with a $350,000 grant. So it's not something that you can create out of existing resources.
Right.
And we would have to identify the different rules that we would need to fund in order to provide the service in our jurisdiction. So we can identify those rules. They gave us the hiring papers that they used and their proposed salaries. We have all of that information. It's just, first of all, determining, do we have the momentum here to set something like that up?
And then the last piece I had was the court issues. It was basically a one-liner that you had here was, we see angry, volatile people on a regular basis. Period. And so it's like, okay, well, I get that. So I think we should be doing something about it as far as we should have some video monitoring inside of courtrooms, et cetera, where there's a direct tie to the dispatch center, at least where they have a monitor that they can watch and a speaker that they can turn up and listen if they wish. During the court process, because you don't have either a private security company or...
Have a bailiff in the courtroom.
All the time?
Most of the time.
Okay.
Most of the time, the bailiff is in there. Our bigger concern is people bringing weapons into the courthouse.
So,
and it's not just in the courtroom, it's the folks at the front desks that are dealing with sometimes very angry, volatile people on just day-to-day traffic matters or whatever. And so they're dealing with people, sometimes they get very frightened.
So,
and not knowing if somebody has a gun or a knife.
Right. So similar metal detection, similar to, or at least some screening, similar to the Lane County Courthouse.
Some sort of screening where people can't bring weapons in
the
courthouse would put my mind at ease a great deal, and I think everyone else's mind at ease. Because we do have a bailiff in the courtroom who, when he sees somebody come in with some sort of a backpack or container, we'll go out and search it, but it's the things that people can bring in that
it's
you
too
can't
late.
See that are the biggest concern.
So who would spearhead that? I mean, I think we
GM
should
look. Has 10 hours.
Yeah, I know. This is something that I think that is our responsibility to look at.
Yeah.
It's we're behind the times, and we need to just say, okay, here we're at the table, we're policymakers, say, okay, that's something we need to do.
We've,
so let's do it.
We've developed some cost estimates for it in the past. We can pull those out and update them.
When I'm looking at the council, we want to look at security.
Because you're talking, you've got the physical equipment and somebody to staff. Because the equipment and not the staffing is.
Would that be a good first step to the security issue, to do that, to have that screening? So that would be a good first step.
I don't think that'd be huge.
Well, we have all the staff, San Francisco staff, and then we have, but we have community meetings there all the time too. So you have people potentially, if you've got somebody running around and they're out of control, it's, you have even more people that are going to be vulnerable.
I think it'd be three people, the judge, Nate, our finance director, and the police chief.
So it'd be like, so let's see if we can get something back. When we do it back. Soon as you got it. I mean, it's a safety.
Tina's going before I leave or after.
No.
Right, it needs to be.
Sometime after your break.
I've heard about this for the last 6 months to, well, more than that, a year, year and a half. And we keep getting that can down, and I see a real a line down here says we see any of all the people on a regular basis. And I'm sitting here as a policymaker, and if someone like her gets hurt because we've been listening to this for a year and a half and we failed to act on it, I see a problem with that.
Right.
So I think we need to bring it to the forefront and recognize we got a safety issue and we have a responsibility to staff and the public, and bring it right to the front. It's kind of like with the video thing. They need to get that rolling. So if we can push that forward, I'm just speaking for myself, sorry, but if people agree, I think that needs to be heard. So that'd be great.
So we'll leave it to you guys, and we'll need some, we'll want something back by, we're after the break, which is September.
I was just wondering about budget, you know, so we need to budget for that. I mean, that's going to, there's some cost involved. And we just modify the budget.
You can modify the budget if that's what you're saying.
We got the pin.
Yes, I realize that.
Yeah.
It's just we have to have the money to back it up.
We do.
So, but.
Yeah. So, Leonard.
I think Councilor Moe had something. No? Oh, okay. Short of establishing an independent mental health court, would it be practical to, or is there any precedent for having a mental health professional on the premises just to evaluate people and their behavior while they're being, I mean, defendants and potentially plaintiffs as well, I mean, for possible treatment and possible placement on a mental health track? Is that, do you know of any systems that have incorporated something like that?
Well, I'm going to let Chief speak to this, because we do have the expectation that the jail is going to have on staff somebody who provides mental health services for the people that are in the jail.
Okay.
And is your question to people that are or people that are just in the court system in general?
Coming before you as the court.
And so we use the community behavioral health, Lincoln Behavioral Health, for that purpose, because that's their charge. That's their mandate. Our community is to provide those services.
Okay.
We get frustrated when we find that they're not as effective as we would like them to be. But
right.
We do refer people to that. We would want to.
I was just going to say they're not necessarily on site when the trials are taking place. So is that right?
They're not.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that we would need to have somebody on site. I think for the most part, the people that are going to have the most pressing mental health issues are the people that are in custody who are getting worse and worse because they're in a custodial setting. They're maybe not taking medications, they may be refusing their medications, not getting treatment. Those are the ones that I have the most concern about.
Sure.
They need to be in a therapeutic setting.
Yeah.
And the jail is not a therapeutic setting.
Well, the thing that I'm thinking about is that, with exceptions, most mentally ill people don't think they're mentally ill. They think everyone else is mentally ill. And so.
And throw into that sometimes substance abuse issues, and it's hard to find out and discern what's substance abuse, what's mental health.
Right.
Did you want to ask the chief?
Well, I just comment that, you know, remember, through the medical provider contract, we have 18 hours with the mental health specialist.
judge is talking about Wayne County Mental Health people that are even fit to stand trial, there's something that does that evaluation at the court's request.
Okay.
We have a psychiatrist come in and do an evaluation, and if they're even fit and appropriate for community restoration, then Lane County Behavioral Health sends in people to engage that person who they're supposed to engage, then we just haven't had a lot of people engaged.
Would that typically be you that flags them for evaluation?
It'd be their defense attorney.
Okay.
Who would identify that they're unable to aid and assist in their defense, or they're unable to appreciate the nature of the proceedings against them.
Got it, okay, thanks.
So, thank you so much. I'm gonna have just a couple of things, you know, the kind of one to reiterate, you know, that we need to look at the public defenders. I think we can all agree on that, because there's someone that's not working with courts at the national level said it's better to be rich and guilty than it is to be poor and innocent. And it's kind of a sad statement about the system if it's working like that. But we need to be more careful, because it goes against what your goals were in what you wrote as the court security. I think we weren't going to work on that one, because I recognize that, you know, it is pretty much an open door, you know, now to go into the Justice Center and just, you know, go about anywhere. The other, though, is really we have to take a look at mental health and substance abuse more seriously, because it does involve our jails. When we stop feeling like people should be in a mental health institution, everybody thinks of Nurse Ratched or something, that then we went away from mental health facilities, so that the change went to, it's our jails that become mental health facilities, because that's the only place we have to deal with the emergency ward and in jail. So we don't have anything that's working effectively. So whether it's going to affect the cost for the city, the cost for the county, the state, the nation, and also it affects our homeless population. If we really want to make some changes, we have to address mental health and substance abuse issues, because it does prevent people from being able to, in any way, be able to live in the society the way we think they ought to live, and they end up out somewhere where they don't have anybody or anywhere, any way to deal with anything, so we cycle them through the jails or in the hospital. So we have to look at it more seriously. That if we're going to put money somewhere, it would be very much to our benefit to look at that. And I agree, it's within the health system. They're the ones with the money, and they're the ones with the wherewithal to actually make something change. So as a health rep, I'm just looking at you.
I'll get my checkbook out.
Okay, thank you. All right, but Trillium is our local, you know, that works with our populations, particularly that are on Oregon Health Plan, et cetera, and how do we make that work for us and bring a higher level of attention to that health system in particular. And I wrote down to talk to maybe one or two county commissioners about making sure that they're working with us the way they need to, so that we have some sort of sense that we trust what's happening, and that we get the services that are supposed to be being provided by the county. So does that make sense to everybody? We're going to look at court security, and we're going to look at public defender system, and we're going to look at some of these the yellow line program, maybe, and some other things like that. So, right? Because we want your job to get better.
So. You'll never be without customers, but we're trying to reduce the length of the line.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Providing a supplemental report to the council.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So, another depressing topic, the development code update. No.
Oh, no.
This is exciting.
Fun
talker. What? I'm going to take marks for 5 minutes while I'm sitting here. These are
or just copies of the communication packet memo you already got in case you need a paper copy? As I promised or threatened in that communication packet memo, we're talking about ethics. So if you recall this communication packet memo from mid-May, we wrote to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. We actually first started with a phone call, and then they wouldn't talk to us on the phone about it anymore. They would only communicate by written letter, which was interesting. But we had read some other ethics opinions that the Oregon Government Ethics Commission has come out with recently about conflicts of interest, and specifically how quote amendments implicate conflicts of interest for elected and appointed officials. And so we wanted to give the council and then the other groups working on this that are public officials some extra guidance and a little bit more security by getting an opinion from staff on the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. So this is the opinion that we requested in writing from them. And if a counselor or elected official acts according to the advice in this opinion, then it's a mitigating factor if you were found to have violated ethics rules later. It can't prevent someone from bringing a charge against you, but it could prevent a sanction. So that's the kind of effect of this. Conflicts of interest, as a reminder, there's potential conflicts that where your official action or recommendation could impact your financial interest or that of your business. And then there are actual conflicts where it would affect your financial interest or a relative's. And so because counselors live in Springfield, many of you own residential property, or some of you may also be involved in developing residential property. And so for the residential phase of this project, we thought there was likely a conflicts of interest issue. The Ethics Commission has said that until we sort of formally get to you post-Planning Commission recommendation on an actual code package, there's no need to worry about actual conflicts of interest. So at this point, you have potential conflicts of interest if you own property in Springfield or involved in developing residential property in Springfield, because code amendments could affect the value of that property. So we thought before each one of these, to keep everything in line with the ethics, we'll just do a real quick around the table, or however the mayor would like to run it, where you declare a potential conflict of interest. That could be as simple as, I own a home in Springfield. That's all I have to say, other than to
have
you do that.
Yeah. I own multiple properties within Springfield. So, but it's interesting how they put this too, because decisions made are so widespread, and most inhabitants, it applies to most inhabitants. It's not, yeah. It wouldn't be a conflict. So, but yeah. Things that would specifically affect my stuff, then I would declare that there's a potential conflict.
So you should declare a potential, I think, for all of these meetings going forward. And then an actual conflict of interest, you may need to declare, depending on your unique circumstances, once we actually have code amendments. But they indicated only the Ethics Commission itself can declare a class, that can declare that all the properties are being affected. And so there is no conflict of interest because it applies to a class. And they've indicated they wouldn't do that for code amendments because each property is unique, the effect on each property is unique. And I think, you know, personally, I wouldn't have taken it that far, but that's where they took it. And so that's one of the implications of that ethics. And one of the opinions that made us reach out to them for more advice.
So I have a potential conflict of interest.
Yes, I declare a potential conflict of interest. I own property in Springfield. Next.
I guess. I own a home in Springfield. So I'm declaring a potential conflict.
Yeah, potential conflict of interest.
I have a potential conflict of interest. I own a home in Springfield.
I have a potential conflict of interest because I have a home in Springfield and property in Glenwood, which is an urban road.
I have a conflict of interest because I own a home and several properties in Springfield.
It has a conflict.
Potential conflict. Okay, we'll try to prompt you to do that every time we bring this topic up to keep you all in the right area. As we get closer to actual code amendments and actual conflicts of interest, we're always available in our office to talk to you individually about questions or concerns you have.
Okay, I have two questions here.
Okay.
Could we do this in such a way we don't have to do it every time?
Unfortunately not. You have to declare a conflict of interest at each meeting. If you do a universal one, though, at the start, and you're first you're talking about setbacks, and then later you move on to height, you don't have to do it for each topic. But if you do it once, it's once per meeting, and that's the way the rules.
Yeah, it's.
We're making every commission, every committee, even the TAC has to do it. And it gets to save a lot of people, and it takes up time, but.
It's a pretty safe assumption that most people at this table own property in Springfield.
Well, and it safeguards us from a problem later. So thank you, Christina, for doing all the work and keeping us on the straight and narrow.
Our government is so awesome.
That's the fun part. So I'm here. That was fun.
Wow, you threw me into the bus.
No, I didn't. I was just joking. Of course, we love to talk about my code.
And we don't have much time to talk about the code, so we're going to do it quick tonight.
Yeah.
But primarily, I'm here for a quarterly check-in with you and to present the final code audit report that you got in your packet for tonight. I do have some hard copies if any of you wanted to see it in paper, but I was planning on having a little more time so I could, I was planning on hitting the high points of the report. I don't have to go through that, but the first thing I want to do is check in on our timeline. The red line on this diagram indicates we're at the end of quarter two. We're halfway through 2019 now. We're right on schedule, basically, as far as task five up there says the code audit housing report will be done, and that's what we're presenting to you tonight. We are moving through drafting of the new housing code sections. I anticipate by my next quarterly check-in in 3 months that we'll be bringing you some draft products that the TAC and I and others will have worked on. We are, as you can see, the red line extends down into this first orange bar on task 9, which is the initiation of the second phase of the project, which is the commercial industrial, or I'm calling the economic development phase. So we're kicking off now where we started with the residential phase, and that is kind of auditing the commercial industrial zone parts of the code, and then we'll be moving into the edits and new development of code for those sections as well. I will touch on in a little bit the recruitment for TAC and how we're going to engage the public on that phase two as well. But really quickly, you have as part of your packet as well, I don't want to go through this, but the purpose and the objectives of the project are the same. I like to just touch on them again every time I come to you. The housing code audit, though, I do want to point out the primary driver behind that is to be in line with state law for having clear and objective standards for approving housing projects. That is a statutory requirement. Part of that statutory requirement includes not only just that they're clear and objective criteria, but also that they don't create delay or excessive cost to approving housing projects. And I think that a lot of the objectives on here are in line with the purpose of the report. I'm going to skip over, just for the sake of time, some of these project tasks. I was just checking and showing you where we are in that initial project task list. And I jumped to what the purpose of the audit report was. So the purpose, I identified it into three different parts. It was identifying the clear and objective standards that I just talked about. In addition to that, identifying regulatory barriers. It may not be that we may have a clear and objective standard, but it could still be a regulatory barrier. That does align a little bit, or can align with creating unreasonable cost and delay as well. So it's a twofold test. Something, again, could be clear and objective, but also create unreasonable cost and delay. And then third, identifying regulatory opportunities to, as some of our objectives for this project say, to support more development and create housing in the community. So really with that, I was gonna, like I said, hit on a couple of high points. Given the time, I can open it up if people have specific questions that they'd like to touch on in the report. There's quite a bit in here, and I can just go through the high points, but I thought I'd ask if anybody has anything specific.
I know I have a few just comments, but they're not specifically questions. Does anyone have questions that they want to ask, Mark? Yes, Sean?
So when you look at the code on it itself, right, like it's, and we think about the rewrite, to me that sounds, there sounds like they're separate things, right? So the rewrite's not going to be we go through the code and correct all the things the audit found. We're creating it again from whole cloth.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was a little bit at the beginning of the audit, understanding we had to sort out with our consultant and the TAC themselves to make sure that was clear to everybody.
And there are several places in the actual report where they say sort of no issues found, if you will, right, when they go through them.
Correct.
And to me, those sections are going to get reworked as well.
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, we are whole cloth going to develop a new code. That new code may include some language out of the existing code. And just because this report identified something as not having any issues doesn't mean we're not going to take a look at those sections as well. Because again, we're looking in the code update, the bigger, broader project, mm-hmm. beyond just the findings of this report, whether they're clearly objective or not.
And I thought there were a lot of good observations in the audit, you know, where it's like these two items don't make sense together. That came up a lot, mm-hmm. and I'm glad that we're going to go through and clean them up. You know, so, all right, thank you.
And I'll leave time at the end for comments. I'll just touch on some of these high points.
Okay.
It'll be quick. But so just starting with the base residential standards, there, and these are really quick high-level bullets, but one of the ones I'll point out that is the fourth bullet down, the solar development standards. That's come up a number of times in our TAC meetings. It was identified in the report. It's one of those standards that was put into place decades ago. So we'll be evaluating whether it makes sense to keep that in place or not. I think there's other sections that talk about, you know, buffering and increased setbacks for compatibility. So I think all of those types of compatibilities and increased setbacks or buffering will be an area that will, in my mind, will be a topic to be decided on through this process that we'll be highlighting. The one area that I don't think anybody has a really good grasp on is the infrastructure development standards. So I touch on it here and even later on in the land division process. And so that is, how do we determine capacity of infrastructure, whether it's streets or sewer pipes or water, you know, sub gets involved with the water or even electricity potentially. So we have very subjective criteria now for determining infrastructure. We kind of defer it to being determined by the director on a case-by-case basis. And so that doesn't really work under the state mandate of clear and objective standards. So that's an area the report talks about getting more guidance from DLCD on, and that it was outside the scope of this report. And it's really because through the conversations we've had, nobody really, us as land use planners, we're dabbling in the engineering stuff that we don't deal with necessarily on a day-to-day basis, but we're trying to bring in our engineering group to try and work with them on identifying how to get those standards clear and objective as well. So that's going to definitely be an area that we'll hear more on. The whole idea of our city engineering staff having the opportunity to receive a report from a developer or a developer's representative, it could be a hired engineer, a licensed professional, and then the city analyzes that report. So it's competing engineering analysis, but really the discretion under the state law is taken away from us to say we have to kind of trust what they submit, or we just are very clear with our standards that you have to show us how you meet these clear and objective standards for capacity or whatever the infrastructure issue is. Again, I mentioned this also plays out in the land division process. So the actual approval criteria themselves talk about as determined by the director. That's not clear and objective. It's very subjective. I'm not going to touch on all of these just for the sake of time. The site plan review process is similar. If you look through the report, you see a lot of repetition in some of these criteria that need to be cleaned up. And then we'll have about 5 minutes for more comments and discussion, but in summary, what I see is this directing us to do is a lot of what we're planning to do already, and that is making our code easier to use, really focusing on the clear and objective standards so developers can look at our code and understand what they're getting themselves into with a particular property that they have ideas or questions about. Focusing on the process pieces, you may have seen in here they talk about how much information we ask for up front and how much detailed plans are required to be submitted at different points of the process. So trying to dial those in to match what our review processes are, so we're not burdening a developer with unnecessary professional reports or analysis that may not be necessarily needed. So with that, I'll turn it back to you. We have just a couple more minutes, but any more comments or questions or feedback on those two?
Well, since I said I had some comments, so if that word nodal went away and we never ever saw it again, I would be really happy.
I've made note of that.
Okay. nice.
Yes. So I'll just say it in a general sense, mm-hmm. is what I saw is that we have, we need to definitely look at the burden of what we put on people when they come in to talk to us. And it's whether it's their experts that, you know, we have clear and objective standards that give us something, is that we don't have somebody here, then that it becomes another, you know, well, our engineers say this, and then it goes back and forth, and then all of a sudden a development's held up, et cetera, et cetera. Is that I think the objective should be, is that you get to come to the counter, it's very simple what the process is, and you then can have something that I think one was pre-development meetings versus DIMS or something like that is let's reduce, the overall objective should be reduce what is needed so that we don't make it such a burden that people just go, I'm just going to go to another town. I don't need to develop here. And we're going to be talking about costs here, particularly in Glenwood and places like that here pretty quick. And how do we overcome that? So all of these things, whether it's remove barriers or land site plan review, streamline, simplify, get down the way, because it costs somebody at that front end so much that if we can make it more reasonable, and then if there's cost, just let them, you know, what they gave us didn't fit, then you can have a discussion about it. But don't start it so that somebody just throws their hands up and goes away. So those are just generally what I saw in the audit,
right,
which don't work very well. There's two specific things, though. I don't like the idea because I have a duplex next to me mid-block, and it faces, it goes this way into the lot,
okay,
that it works. And so where the rest of us all have one piece of property that or one home, there's actually a duplex. So take a look at the options rather than just on a corner lot, because duplexes are also a type of higher density style housing, and if we can slide them in there, and there that lot isn't even as deep as mine is, and it has a duplex in it and backyards and front yard, is to take a look at that. And then somewhere we had where apartment houses needed to have some of the units face the street, because otherwise they become a little, you know, they're completely enclosed with, and I see the apartments that are just going in that all have, they're all, the backs of them are all against the street. There's nobody in the front, but I don't know why the park at Emerald Village had to put ones facing the street specifically, but I remember talking about it, that it makes the apartment house part of the neighborhood then. So is to take a look at that if you've got an apartment house, that they don't all face inward. It's just, you know, is just to take a look at some variations about how we do that if we're looking at higher density style housing. That we don't isolate one group of people from everyone else that's in a neighborhood. Sharon?
So I just am interested in looking at residential zoning and laws would Airbnbs come under this, any kind of restrictions or things we might consider putting on?
It could Airbnbs. Come under that. We don't currently regulate Airbnbs.
I'm right. I realize we don't, but if in fact we were to look at that, it
That's
would come under this section?
Correct.
Okay, and then my other question
is... Well, just a quick caveat. I think it could potentially fall under business licenses as well. I'm not sure if we've talked about that or not.
Right now there's overlap. Some aspects of a rooming or boarding house fall under development code, but you don't specifically meet that definition the way that it's done there. It would be exempted under the development code. We have some, we do transient room tax through the municipal code,
right.
Other jurisdictions for whether you're, you know, it's the form of development and then whether it's being used for permanent occupants or for Airbnb, that would be regulated as a business license more typically. But
then under the residential, what we would allow in residential. I know I bring that up because.
It could be either or, I think, to
yeah.
summarize what Mark said.
Meeting with the Historic Commission, there's a continual concern about in the district, what was it called?
Historic district.
Right, historic district, about whether or not that, you know, there's some allowances or whatever.
Sure.
And then my other question has to do with rooming homes and boarding, and we restrict to unrelated. Individuals a certain number, and I just wondered where that number, if that would come under this residential as well.
Is that a federal definition or state for the number
know.
Of family, related family?
Well, I'm just concerned because
I mean, it's in our code, but I don't know what the source of it is.
We can look into that. That would be where this would land as well.
Okay, is that nice? Well, I mean, because I'm thinking, you know, we're looking at expanding housing and. You know, we have a restriction for the number of unrelated people living in a home, and that, you know, is there, where does that come from, I guess,
yeah.
is my
okay.
thinking, and do we need to have that?
I just wanted to comment on the, I'm a consistency person, I wanted to comment on reading through this and seeing that some of the things are brought out about the discretion. And standardizing the discretionary decisions, supervisors or whatever at particular points in time. I like the fact that that was brought out, and I like the fact that it's been going to be looked at because the I think the more consistent. I mean, there are times when flexibility is important, but the most consistent you can be simplifies the process, and I liked. My only comment was that I liked when I read through it that that was there to be looked at.
Great.
Sean? Two comments. When it comes to housing, and I think it's really important that we explore the idea of really opening up what, by whatever the zoning is, what is the allowable housing. I mean, it talks about the duplexes, but I really am in favor of, like, giving the development community a goal and really opening up the way they get there. Right, so if it's duplexes or clusters or, you know, I don't know, three more ADUs, right, like, I want to give them more direction and less restrictive on the actual how, if that makes sense.
Okay.
The second thing, and I think this is worth the conversation internally, and I don't know if it means you bring it back in the same time when we do the next code update or not, is really to make it the investment out of this, it's going to require business change in development and public works. And I don't know if that conversation happens at the same time or not, but really I would like to see how the staff's going to sort of, I guess, implement this, but internally. And I think that to me that extends to is who's going to care for the entire code, right? Because we have, you know, this is 30 years old. We have a number of people writing in this and updates that we make, and we kind of broke all the internal inconsistency, and it's really, I think, easy as policymakers to be like, okay, let's pull on this one section and see what happens. But really, we need to have somebody that's going to care for the entire vision of what we're trying to do.
Great.
So, it did make me think of what you were talking about. If we do look at being able to do kind of what kind of housing we're specifically talking about, folks that, you know, you need to have a variety of housing types, and maybe it is a room and board sort of a situation, is make sure that we can account for that kind of housing. And maybe we do need to specifically address sometimes the Airbnb, just because I sit at the traveling county table and the hoteliers don't like Airbnbs because you don't have to do as many, you know, you don't have to have ADA requirements, you don't have to have all kinds of things that they have to have. And so it's not, to them, it's not a level playing field. So if nothing else, is have some sort of take a look at it in terms of requirements that make it safer if you're going to use a residence as an Airbnb, and see if you know where is the consistency in terms of that.
The other issue with Airbnb is just taking long-term rentals off the market and making them short-term because they're more profitable. And so we have over 300 Airbnbs in the Three Kings area. I mean, that's a lot of spaces.
Yes.
And it's going to increase because people are looking at purchasing homes and turning them into Airbnbs for the 2021. I mean, I don't know where they see that as being, you know, for a month, but.
Well, but it is a consider, and other communities have set limits.
Right.
And so, you know I brought it up before, so do we need to take a look at, you know, how we go about doing that so that we don't have the problems I've seen in some communities, but some communities definitely have, you know, they sell them as party, right?
Yeah.
Party for the weekend or whatever, and so, you know, so it's really not popular in the neighborhood, so, yeah.
Well, thank you for your comments and time. But in terms of next steps, we are trying to recruit for a TAC for the commercial industrial phase. That recruitment's been open a month already, and we've only gotten 2 applicants. So if you know of anybody that might be interested in that TAC, I've talked to Ed Moore, and we have some names identified, but we have some thoughts about if we can't recruit enough people for a TAC, that we'll do some outreach in other ways in alignment with our community engagement plan and just keep ahead with the work we're doing. But we're also going to be checking with the Planning Commission in a week to bring them up to date along the lines of what we've heard tonight, and we'll just keep going at it and come back and check in with you again. So.
You may have to go to them, you know, just talk to a commercial, you know,
yeah.
Figure out some sort of a way that it's a series of questions or something and get some feedback, and then ask them if, because I know some of them don't use email either, so. You know, it would be more, is get them to sit down for a few minutes.
Yeah. That's a great idea. And regardless of the TAC, we plan to do community conversations and one-on-one interviews and stakeholder outreach and that kind of stuff regardless. So.
Great.
Great.
Good job. See, it was so much fun. It was fun.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, so with that, we are going to adjourn the work session